I'm delighted to introduce Hannah Koffsham this morning because a couple of reasons, but the main reason being Hannah is a new speaker to Greenbelt. She's not new to Greenbelt itself, but this is the first time she's spoken. Is that right? Yes. And as part of the talks team, sorry, my name's Jill Hewitt, and part of the talks team, we're always very, very pleased to have a new speaker and to launch somebody new. So for that reason, I'm absolutely delighted. The other reason is that Hannah is also on the talks team, so we've got to work together and get to know each other really well this past year. Hannah works in public relations in a well-known health charity, and she helps, as I said, she helps coordinate the talks programme for Greenbelt, and she edits Faith in Practice interviews for Third Way magazine. So I think we're going to have a really good morning, and you've already heard the title of her talk. So now that we're all in the right place, we're all in Janine at the right seminar, let's give Hannah a warm welcome.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to start with a very quick caveat. I've had a really interesting 24 hours involving my computer, and for various reasons I can't tell you the story, but if you want to buy me a pint in the Jesus Arms later, I'll regale it to you. Suffice it to say, I never got around to writing the conclusion to my talk, so all bets are off when I get to the end of the script. And I also want to thank you for being here, because I'm not sure how the message got out. I'm particularly pleased you're here because I don't work in public relations. If I did work in public relations, this talk might get me in a lot of trouble. And the fact that you're here seeing that I work in public relations is probably testament more to the subject than it is to that. I'm actually in fundraising and project management, but you'll hear about that in a bit. So, to the actual talk. My name's Hannah, and I work in the charity sector. I've worked there all my adult life, and I'm really proud to do so. About 4 years ago, my friend Hugh Spanner phoned me up, because he was doing a piece for Church Times about people who worked in charity and why they did that. And he thought I'd be good for a quote. Unfortunately, the quote I gave made me sound so worthy. something on the lines of me wanting to give back and unable to be in the corporate sector. I know I meant every word, but it was really unsettling to see it in print. And yet, here I am, talking about the same passion, this time with my words being recorded. Perhaps I just really like sounding worthy. In May 2006, the Office of the Third Sector was created as a division within the Cabinet Office in recognition of the increasingly important role the third sector was playing in society and the economy. It was quite a bold move by the Labour Party, since the sector, as a natural part of social fabric, had been bumbling along happily for 1,000 years without needing its own division. The move gave rise to initiatives, lots of initiatives, intended to help the sector grow and develop. A year later, I, an excitable young member of the Lib Dems at the time, sent a proposal to Ed Davey, suggesting that the Lib Dems create a shadow minister role that mirrored, but also went several steps further than the one that Ed Miliband had at the time. He really kindly met with me and bought me 2 cups of coffee while we had a chat. Nothing came of it. In many ways, this talk is an extenuation of the conversation that I had all those years ago. In 2010, the Condem coalition government changed the name of the division to the Office of the Civil Society, inspired by big society that was so much a part of David Cameron's platform. Because, as we all know, Dave is a man of the people, and his ideas about big society were a chance for him to reflect back to us the community action that made Britain great, which he'd noticed. The charities and charitable work that has been around for hundreds of years needed a facelift, a new name, a brand. Big society, charities, community action, and the contribution of third sector organisations to social and economic evolution is a huge subject, which people far more intelligent than I have written on. But I have the privilege to explore some thoughts and ideas with you today, for which I thank Greenbelt and Jill in particular. So I'm going to explore what I know about the sector from working in it, knowing the people involved. I want to explore some misnomers used to describe the sector, which I think have given rise to misunderstandings that don't help charities grow and develop. And I want to briefly cover why I think big society might have its heart in the right place, but it's out of touch with the realities of the needs of the real 21st century charity. I'm also not going to try and name specific charities in the course of my talk, although there are a few it's difficult not to, or local government organisations, partly because I haven't asked their permission and it seems like poor etiquette, but mostly because for every one example I might put forward, there are more that will spring to your mind that you know of either nationally or locally, and I hope that by speaking to the broader picture, it can speak more to your personal experience than something I want to put forward. So, let's start with one of the most frustrating misnomers for the charitable sector and the one which really gets my goat, that we're not for profit. What utter rubbish. Many charities based in the UK, whether they work at home or abroad, are very much run for profit. In my day job, I work with a team charged with raising over £10 million to help improve the lives of people affected by cancer. I won't give away any trade secrets, but essentially we encourage people, particularly those who know how important the emotional and clinical support is for anyone on a cancer journey, to hold an event that raises money for that charity and that cause. We don't spend £10 million doing it. Far from it. Our performance is monitored carefully, especially how much investment is made in promoting the fundraising event to our supporters. And the return on that investment is our primary focus, because the more profit we make, the more we're able to deliver on what we promised we would do with the money that we helped raise. In 2007, a research paper was written by a group of business and accounting academics based on a survey of chief financial officers of large charitable organisations in Australia. It's not a survey of managing executives, people that traditionally speak on behalf of the sector, but the qualified financial executives that help run these charities, serious financial types with the kind of training that gets recognised across every sector. Among their findings was the belief that the public is entitled to receive high-quality financial disclosure from charities, and particularly that profit should be approached as a relevant performance indicator, rather than a cash surplus or deficit. And yet, the article written up on this research paper in the Australian broadsheet The Age bore the title, "Nonprofits Can Be More Accountable." Hang on. These same charities that should represent the money they make as profit rather than cash flow, did the journalist read the research paper? Why are we so reluctant to lose the label non-profit? Perhaps our reluctance to consider the money made by charities as profit is because so much of it is donated by individuals, companies, foundations, trusts, even children. Donated rather than spent. That said, many of those kind of donations could be considered an exchange of goods or services, a feeling of altruism, contribution to corporate social responsibility targets, or literally the provision of local, national, or international services, even if it's not necessarily the person doing the donating that benefits. However, it's also money given on the understanding it will be used to support, help, or advocate on behalf of the people, communities, and, well, I'm always less comfortable with this one, animals. And therefore more difficult to reconcile with the same language reserved for banks, businesses, and Starbucks. Perhaps it's the association with these banks and businesses that the word profit has, i.e. surplus of money raised, not raised going to the shareholders, more on which later. That means we prefer to consider work done by charities as something integral to a better society rather than funded by it. Of course, when you buy your non-fat mocha frappuccino, it's for your benefit and not Jerry Baldwin's, right? However, not all charitable organisations have a profit-making structure. I've worked in several charities where the people working there have been expected to cover their own wage, usually by being successful in bids for local or government funding that supports their role and the positive impact it will have. There are many charities that deliver services on behalf of local authorities, contracted to make a difference. In South London, where I currently live, there are charities that train people in work-related skills, provide elderly people with company and support, offer childcare to parents in full-time employment, many more examples like that. These kind of charities often don't survive on a profit-making structure, but they do live and die by the tenders and contracts available for their staff and volunteers to be the difference they want to see in the world. You see, this is the USP that a charitable organisation provides when it helps deliver a public service. What you're missing in pension funds and reserves, you gain in people skills and on-the-ground experience. Unfortunately, this hasn't been a factor in some of the decisions made by government agencies deciding on public sector providers. 6 years ago, I was part of a small local charity that cooperatively bid for a welfare-to-work contract along with several other smaller charities. The contract was won by a large private sector company, able to meet the criteria for having a high enough turnover to appear financially sustainable. Their first act? Subcontracting the work to the very charities that bid for it in the first place. And change is in the air for local government funding. Service providers have been known to invoice monthly or quarterly on the basis of work done. But local authorities may be moving towards an outcomes-based system that might mean invoices wouldn't be paid for up to 18 months. That would mean a charity with a small workforce and even smaller reserves would be far less able to bid, since those timescales would be unsustainable for long-term survival. With this in mind, don't be surprised if a chaste red brand becomes the largest provider of childcare in the country in the next 3 years, which didn't hurt it from me. When Sian Berry ran for London Mayor in 2008, one of her suggestions was local government contracts of at least 3 years, because it opened the doors to more organisations being able to help deliver local services, not least because they have a longer period of time to make the kind of impact that requires an investment of time, and would level the playing field for them to compete with the big companies for the contracts. Needless to say, Boris did not adopt the idea. Policies like this render charities unattractive, since they can't provide the financial stability to deliver on such contracts, opening the doors to more private companies subcontracting the work and reaping the profit. Oh yes, because when it's a company doing it, it's okay to use the word profit. Meanwhile, Big Society launched their own bank, otherwise known as Big Society Capital. How exciting. I think it's one of those banks that gives out money rather than stores it. At least that's what the blurb says. However, and I want to check this, Big Society Bank appears to favour funding capital projects, investment in infrastructure and stuff, rather than day-to-day running costs and long-term upkeep. Interestingly, a very well-known charity with fantastic branding has a similar remit, and it's making it very difficult for them to give away the millions they've raised over the last 5 years. Because the offer to build a swimming pool in your local community looks a lot less appealing when you're not also offering to cover maintenance, cleaning costs, and the people who will make it a useful investment. But that does bring me on to the next misnomer, that the third sector is the voluntary sector. Boy, does that cause confusion. Even today, when I tell someone I work for a charity, I still occasionally get asked if I get paid. Yes, I do. I am able to pay my rent, my bills, get a train ticket to Cheltenham, buy one of those natty Greenbelt hoodies, and buy a copy of The Pilgrim's Progress in Colour, an excellent new reading of Bunyan's classic, available now at the Greenbelt bookstore. That said, the charity sector is the single biggest user of voluntary services. Trustees are unpaid. Many, many small charities thrive on the energies of people willing to put their spare time into a cause close to their heart, and big charities are almost militant in their recruitment of unpaid interns. In the last few weeks, volunteers have had their much-deserved day in the sun, with the huge success and appreciation shown for the Olympic Games makers, the 7,000 people that were so integral to what was frankly a brilliant London Games. Oh, sorry, I'm so used to hearing cheers after those words. It's quite disconcerting being left with silence. They were brilliant! Yeah. And of them that were unpaid, they were also very well managed. There was a whole team behind the scenes responsible for communication, support, training, pastoral services. We've got one of the pastoral services here. Have we got any games makers here? Wonderful. Well, Andy. Paid staff, themselves also considered games makers, were able to fill the gaps, support the activity of the many wonderful men and women who gave up their time to make the games so spectacular. Has anyone worked with or managed a volunteer? Yeah. They're not always easy to deal with. In many ways, it's harder to manage volunteers than paid staff, especially if they're highly skilled volunteers being asked to do the little jobs. I think one of the real successes of the Olympic volunteering team was being able to engender a sense of excitement and enthusiasm among the individuals asked to stand at Bermondsey Station several miles from the action with a foam hand, a smile on their face and advice for bewildered tourists. However, we don't need to look to the £9 billion London Olympics for an example of a seriously high-quality volunteer force. Look around you. This year, Greenbelt has something like 1,200 volunteers on site. Some of them, like myself, have spent several months in the lead-up to the event helping pull the programme or the operational teams together. Some of them are doing 7 hours and more of their time every day this weekend in return for being one of the people that make this festival the inspiring, safe and wonderful place it is. In fact, my silver band even says the words festival maker. Looks like volunteering is going to get a facelift as well. But Greenbelt is also delivered by a 12-strong team that work full or part-time in the office, including the lovely Linda Watson, Greenbelt's volunteer coordinator. Last year, they created a volunteer vid with a beautiful poem by the equally lovely Padre Kutuama, showing the wealth of personality types, motivations, sheer force of life that make up the Greenbelt volunteers. I was hoping to show you the video, but unfortunately there's no Wi-Fi, but do look on the website, it's brilliant. Because this is another USP of the charity sector. We are, or can be, incredibly good at creating and managing an excellent volunteering experience and using people's time in a way that means they have ownership over it. They know what they're doing. They feel empowered. We don't always get it right, though. But we are not the only sector that uses or relies upon a voluntary workforce. I was chatting to someone this week who works in computer games, very competitive industry, and he coined the phrase speculative volunteering, a concept that people will work for free because they know it will benefit them in the end. Ironically, many unpaid interns in the voluntary sector are hoping their stint will get them a paid job in the long term. However, in the private sector, it's taken somewhat for granted. A very good friend of mine spent several months last year working 15 hours a week for a startup in his spare time. He wasn't doing it because he's a good person. He would be the first to say he's just okay. He's doing it because if the startup became successful, he would be in excellent position to get a paid job with them. That's not all that different from when a charity moves from being an entirely volunteer-run affair to investing in paid staff. Is a charity with no employees and therefore less expenditure on profit-making activities more deserving? In my experience, it's a matter of resource and ambition. For instance, I'll be watching the development of the Mo Farah Foundation with interest. Registered on the 1st of September 2011, the accounts aren't yet available. On the Charity Commission website, by the way, which is a wonderful resource, and I relied upon a lot. It doesn't look like they have any current paid staff at the moment, which in the wake of Mo's high profile is fairly understandable, since generation of voluntary income at the moment will be relatively easy. I'm a little bit jealous. However, if their profile and their profit continues to grow, it may be unsustainable for them not to invest in staff roles. I'm a trustee for the most excellent charity, Street Action. That's streetaction.org, in case you're interested. And we have similar questions to answer around our work. While all of us on the board put in hours of work and energy, without being able to devote whole days or more consistent resource in the day-to-day running, it's difficult to be consistently effective. And having interns to help us? Well, there's the rub. Interns need support and management, which can't be shoehorned into lunch breaks, hastily written emails, and after-work meetings where available. The Office of Civil Society recently appointed a provider for the new Community Organisers Programme. As the press release explains, this is a well-trained and committed individuals who will play a major role in delivering the big society dream. They will be trained and given bursaries of £20,000 for their first year, along with a further 4,500 part-time and voluntary organisers who will support them. Read for that, they will manage. What the blurb fails to explain is how long these roles are meant to last for, beyond the year. If someone signs up but leaves after a year, that bursary starts to look a lot more like a stipend. One of the great things about volunteering for Greenbelt is you know the timescale. As a trustee, you know your responsibilities. You have the ownership over the time you put in. The new big thing is micro-volunteering. Here it began with Orange Rock Corps, when in 2008, three optimistic hippie types with a corporate background brought the idea they'd pioneered in California 3 years earlier to the UK, partnering themselves with some big business names and even bigger music names, and began to motivate young people to give 2 hours of their time in return for exclusive tickets to their own run concerts. The reasoning behind it was that if you can give young people an experience of volunteering at a young age, they're more likely to give up their time to volunteer when they're older. I had the privilege to meet Stephen Green, who's one of the founders. I'm quite good friends with him. And he's genuinely passionate about it. It's not about hobnobbing with big music names. He genuinely believes that that's the case. But from 2 hours to 5 minutes, the day after the Olympic closing ceremony, the Join In initiative was launched. The premise: give just 5 minutes of your time to a local sports club or venue. Looking on the website, it's a little less clear what you're being asked to do, a big no-no if you want to have a happy, motivated volunteer workforce. But what I remember of the campaign is the marvellous Eddie Izzard telling me on BBC Breakfast that I only have to give 5 minutes of my time and I too will be as special as a games maker. What a contrast between the two. Full-time volunteer roles and five-minute chunks of people's time. I'm not sure how successful either of these volunteering initiatives will be in the long run. Much like the volunteer-run schools initiative that was all over Radio 4 18 months ago, but has since gone strangely quiet. I think it may be evidence that the Office of Civil Society doesn't quite get how to make the most of people's interest in volunteering. And so on to the third misnomer. Not so much a misnomer as a phrase that seems to have so many different definitions. It's in danger of losing all meaning. Social enterprise. Where do I even start with this one? How about in 2008, when I was lucky enough to be invited to the launch of the Social Enterprise Coalition? As part of the launch, they introduced us to their 20 social enterprise ambassadors, people that had started and successfully run social enterprises long before it became part of policy and government noticed it happening. These people are absolutely brilliant, experienced, effective, and most of all opinionated. And in their opinion, at least some of them, the idea of providing funding to potential social enterprises disenfranchised the business acumen of the very people running the enterprises. Loans for startups were fine, but not this patronising approach that asked charities with financial difficulties to register as a business and start creating profit to support their social impact. Entrepreneurs with a good business model will make it work, they said. I was working at a membership charity at the time, and we supported several of our members in bids to become and hopefully survive as social enterprises. It was frankly embarrassing at times. When people with no business instincts whatsoever were being asked to adapt their existing charitable infrastructure to bring in a profit from the actual provision of goods and services, rather than the altruism or government funding that I mentioned earlier. In a circular reference to my original point about profit, some charities are also social enterprises, and yes, they do make a profit. I just wanted to wait until now before I use this particular buzzword, or should it be buzz phrase. But what makes a social enterprise different from a socially responsible company is what they do with that profit. Staff are paid a fair wage. Often both staff and volunteer roles within the social enterprise are part of the social impact they want to achieve. And most importantly, there's no bunch of shareholders raking in the profitable results from their original investment. The profit is released to allow the social enterprise to do more social good, rather than line the profits of individuals and investment funds. A friend of mine mentioned the other day he knows someone who wants to set up a business that provides more ergonomic office furniture to people that want it. He tells everyone he runs a social enterprise because he's having a positive social impact. I want to use a rude word, but I won't. I was at a talk given by one of those social enterprise ambassadors I mentioned a few years ago, and he talked about a piece of research done in Holland on socially responsible business. Unfortunately, I've never been able to find it in full. I think my Dutch isn't up to an effective Google search. But I remember vividly three of the five tenets they held up as characteristics of a socially responsible business, or in this language, hopefully, social enterprise. One of them was that no one in the business could be paid more than five times what the lowest member of staff was paid. I know a guy who has set up, I've got a friend who set up his social enterprise, and he regularly deals with really big businesses, really big people, and he's damn good at it. But he can't let them know what he gets paid or pays himself, because it makes him look weak. Surely, as a successful businessman, he should be rewarding himself with a salary that recognises value and importance to the business. People like Mark Thomas, who owns so much of the BBC. He was worth it, obviously. Another tenet was the search for qualitative rather than quantitative growth, the impetus to do what you do better rather than just more of it. And the last one I remember was about investing in staff above profit. Frustratingly, for the purpose of this talk, I can't remember the details of this one, but I think the concept he was trying to put across was that in order for your workforce to be productive, they need to feel a valued part of the process rather than a dispensable cog in the machine. I probably sound like an optimistic social hippie to you, but I've read Acts in the Bible, and I've read about the fact that usury is not cool, yet your yes be yes. Let there be fairness in people's business dealings. I also have half a word sitting here on my piece of paper, so this is where I get a bit freestyle. I think what I wanted to say in this talk is that, first and foremost, it's not about faith. There are plenty of people who aren't Christians who are doing good social good. So we're no special if we are Christians. But that the charity sector is such a beautiful working of God's kingdom in the world. And I want it to thrive and grow. And I honestly think, looking at this idea of not-for-profit, yes, we are, voluntary sector, but we still need to have people that do jobs. And social enterprise, the idea of a business that isn't entirely run for the benefit of a small number of individuals who are frankly going to just fritter away that money. You could create something quite beautiful in this world that isn't about having a charitable sector, but is instead about having a socially responsible way of delivering the things that make society a happy place to be. I think that's what I wanted to say. Does anyone have any questions?
Thanks for your talk, that was excellent. The Charity Commission is looking at a move towards paying trustees for larger charities. Any views on that?
Well, interestingly, do I need to use the microphone at this point?
Okay. It's all recorded.
Sorry. Interestingly, I mentioned the Street Action I work with. A few members of the team are themselves freelance people, and would quite like to be able to do stuff for Street Action as part of a paid, like a small bit of contract. And so we started looking into the idea that trustees could be paid. I think that model's more interesting because you do have that framework. What is it you're helping to achieve in that moment? Rather than it being that kind of salary thing, you know, you're paid a salary for what you do. I think that helps focus it, and I think that comes back to what I was saying about volunteers, having a time frame, having that kind of, it's not just this extending onwards into the future. I don't think it's a bad idea, but I do think it means charities have to be, it comes back to this financial accountability. If you give a pound to a charity, you want to know how much of that pound is going into making the next pound or, you know, or delivering what you're doing. So I think it's a good move, but I think it probably needs to be managed in an interesting way. And I hope it's not the terribly nice corporate people that hit 50 have a bit of a breakdown and decide that they're going to give back to charities and turn up at charities and give them all the corporate ideas that they have, because that would not help us move forward.
Thank you. I'm going to have to make a few confessions on my own here. Firstly, I work for central government or devolved government, so I'm a funder of voluntary third sector charity bodies through a project which is European money.
Always fun to work with.
Exactly. I have mug written on my face, basically.
Well, with European money, though, you do have to spend money on the monitoring because
yes,
you're so
I know.
Keen on it.
Exactly. And I'm monitored as well, so I can't escape it. But you're saying about the difficulty of moving to payment by results or payment by outcomes. The trouble is that as we're getting increasingly pressed to show the outcomes for what we're spending, we need to press that on. Mm. I'm not sure that some of that circle can be squared, quite honestly, if we've got a funding mechanism which is becoming increasingly results-based and charities are working on basically on a hand-to-mouth logic, if you like. The other thing you were saying about moving from surplus to profit-based approach, I also have to admit that my wife is an accountant. So at this point, she would say you're going to have to rewrite the entire international accounting system in order to do that. So you might be stretching a little bit far. I think perhaps the concept of profit rather than actually calling things profit might be the way forward. But at the moment, with the restrictions on funding coming through, and as always with European money, as it comes to an end, everyone says, well, when's the next lot? And I keep telling them you can't have a next lot because that's not how it's meant to work, but they do anyway. How do you see all this working in with increasing restrictions coming through? And when you've got money going towards a capital scheme, as you're saying, the big society capital bank, when there's no revenue funding to get things going?
Sorry, I've got a friend who talks about Palestine a lot. He's quite passionate about it. And he gets the talk and people say, well, what is this third way you keep talking about that's going to solve the Palestinian thing? And he kind of mumbles the answer. And I'm about to do the same thing. I think it is about a huge change. I think, in all honesty, if we're able to make what charities deliver and be able to deliver that USP stuff better in the long run, it's actually about going to business, but in a way that doesn't mean it's a business being nice and supporting the charity. Instead, it's the idea that actually, if we can, I mean, it's a pipe dream, but influence that business to try and look at the idea that you could reinvest profit, that does it really have to go to these small number of individuals, that reinvestment is not corporate social responsibility. It's not the 250 quid of match funding that a bank branch will nicely give its people. But in fact, it's a culture change. And that idea of entrepreneurs, the idea that business is a really great way of helping people give money or donate money or spend money that will not just satisfy their needs at that moment, but also be an investment in the social framework as we go forward. So I actually think we do need to move away from funding, actually, and that idea of wait for the next lot of funding, especially as well because restricted people will pretend they're going to do the most crazy things in bids. They're really not going to do it. They're just doing it to get the money. And in my charity, restricting funding is a pain because once you've delivered that project, what are you going to do with the rest of the money? You promised everyone that gave it to you that you were going to do it on that project. So I actually think that funding's, you almost need to say to government, this is what I find interesting about this whole Office of the Third Sector being created 1,000 years after charities have been doing what they do. In some ways, I feel like government kind of needs to back away a bit or at least work in real partnership rather than in this kind of hierarchical my father-child relationship that says you stand there with your hands open waiting for the next lot of funding. Does that make sense? Yeah. Kind of, yeah.
Sorry that this is being recorded because I'm not sure you can be quite as honest as you might be, but do you think there's any future whatsoever for David Cameron's Big Society?
I said at the beginning, Big Society has its heart in the right place. And it does look like this guy, Dave, when I went to the launch of the Social Enterprise Coalition, Dave was there, and it was when I've seen Dave speak 3 times now. First time I saw him speak was before he'd become the leader of the Conservatives, and it was when I was with Teach First. And he stood up there and he said, isn't it lovely all you intelligent young people giving back society by doing this teaching thing, which we got paid for. I mean, not a great amount because we didn't actually have a PGCE. It's a great experience, by the way. The next time I saw him speak was at Social Enterprise Conference, and he, at that point, was the leader of the Conservatives. And he stood there in front of all these social entrepreneurs and said, isn't it amazing what you're doing? You're being so good. You're doing business, but you're not doing it to line your own profits. You're wonderful. You're great people. And then, you know, I've heard him speak way too many times since then on TV. I think that it's literally just a branding exercise. I don't think that any of those policies are really thought through holistically. I think it's just like what government does all the time, where they keep launching things because they need to look like they're effective rather than launching effective things. So essentially, I don't actually think big society is robust enough to have a future. Am I going to get in trouble for saying that? Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I'd hope I'm not. But I think, to mention the fact of what Dave says, I think Dave likes noticing things and reflecting them back at people because he's so lofty and above us all.
Hi, I really recognise what you were saying about the dangers of the move to commissioning and the dangers of big businesses picking up the contracts. And I think that's partly because of the laziness of funders, because it's easier to give contracts to big organisations with them subcontract. And that's also the same with putting money into capital projects rather than revenue projects. It's so much easier to monitor them, and they can see the political gains of things happening at the local level. But on the other hand, and I'd like interested in your reflections on, there seems to be a move towards much more interest in added impact and outcomes and social return on investment. And it seems to me that smaller voluntary community organisations need to get much better at saying not just what they do, but the wider impact of what they're doing. And in view of where the sort of legislation's going, that seems to me to be something that should be sort of emphasised. I just value your sort of comments on that.
I totally agree. They've been trying to hash it out for years. And what does this social impact look like? The reason I started supporting Street Action, I started giving money before I became trustee. The reason I started supporting them was at the time, so go back to the gentleman's thing, I was part of the membership charity and we had EU funding. And the monitoring of it was the bane of my life. And when my friend was talking to me about what Street Action did, he used this phrase, and I mean, he doesn't even remember using this phrase, but he said, we're there for the child when they need us. Sometimes we lose them, sometimes they go, sometimes it's amazing and we're able to take them on a journey, but we're there at the time that we need us. And for me, it was amazing. It wasn't, we help 12 children come off the streets every year. It wasn't, we take four people into jobs. It was just something so emotive. And it's really hard to show that kind of investment. The membership charity that I worked for had a lot of volunteers who worked at our companies that were long-term unemployed, because of mental health issues or because they were differently abled. And the kind of impact you had there was phenomenal. Really hard to put on paper. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I'm a kind of person that really likes spreadsheets and numbers, so I do find it quite difficult to put that down. But I think it has to be anecdotal. I think it has to be qualitative. One of the tenets of project management is actually that you have a KPI, you have what you're going to get as an outcome, and you can have quantitative outcomes, you can also have qualitative ones. And a lot of the people who do projects at my charity have to rely on qualitative outcomes, anecdotes, people saying how they felt about something. Maybe that's the way you try and do that. You try and show that you were there for someone at the point in their journey. But I don't know. I'm afraid there's not an easy answer to that. I think I've rehashed that answer a bit.
Sort of following on from the qualitative quantitative thing, I work in local government and we...
That's okay. We'll pray for you later.
Within our team, it's in homelessness, and we've got an officer who works with 16, 17-year-olds, and she's always being asked to prove quantitatively. And so there's always this challenge to massage the figures to make them look right. How do you feel about ethically essentially making figures say what they're not supposed to say just to get the funding?
I'd ask Bob Diamond that same question. I actually think you don't necessarily have to massage the figures. Not really. That comment about the street children, you're there at that time. Why not just have a little tally? I spoke to this homeless guy. I mean, in fact, homelessness is a really interesting one because sometimes people are so entrenched, they'll never be able to get off the street. Why not put that down? You know, why not they make that something that government tries to understand? That actually... Well, in which case, this is what I find really interesting. People, especially people who work in charities, we're nice people. We sit around, we talk about these things, and we're never quite brave enough to challenge the status quo. And we're never quite sure how to rally together to challenge that status quo. Do we pick our battles because we think they're easier to solve? Do we get into government? I mean, how brilliant would it be if, well, first of all, some of the MPs in the cabinets that they're running knew anything about the cabinet that they were running? Michael Gove. I'm a big eternal hippie optimist type. I think massaging the figures is ethically fine in my head as long as the woman is thinking about how potentially she could change things, potentially influence things, potentially change her reporting in such a way that someone says, oh, that's interesting, that's new, what's that mean? Maybe. And maybe she can talk to other homeless workers in the area, and maybe together they can do that. There's a bunch of people who do payroll giving, and there's a forum, and they are desperately trying to fix payroll giving because it is stuck in the 19th century. Did we have checks in the 19th century? It's stuck back with checks still. I mean, it's awful. And they're big charities and small ones working together to try and come up with proposals to go to the Charity Commission, show to the Charity Aid Foundation to try and affect payroll. Let's do more of that, I think. I think sharing our frustrations is no bad thing.
Hi, I classify myself, name myself as a serial volunteer. So I'm a trustee of 8 local charities and
wow.
I volunteer full time. And when I heard about the Big Society, I was literally buoyed. Fantastic, things are going to value volunteers. What's happening local level on the ground is going to make a difference. Nothing. Diddly squat. And then the games makers. I was like, fantastic. Things are going to change again. I have this horrible sinking feeling it's not. Do you think our society can get to a place where people who volunteer because they believe it will make a difference are actually valued for what they do rather than what they don't earn?
I bloody hope so. I do. I just think... I think it's interesting. So, as I said, big charities are militant in hiring unpaid interns. I mean, this will get me in trouble. But will anything interesting? I didn't say this. They will say if there's a job that needs to be done and it looks like there's no one around to do it, they'll say, "Oh, we'll get an intern." And that's not a good attitude. So if it's happening at that side, then that's not great going forward. I think Big Society won't do it. I think that this concept of speculative volunteering, I think what might happen in the next few years is that private companies will have to hire people with skills that know how to manage volunteers. And I think as soon as that kind of activity moves into the corporate sector, that's when it starts getting recognised more. It doesn't sit as well because obviously you're wanting to make a difference in the world, in your community, in the social fabric. I do hope that the games maker ideal gets moved forward, but I also hope it gets moved forward in a way that says volunteers shouldn't be exploited. I think the best way to do it is just, you know, well, with social networking and with the power of the internet, we can create our own news. I think it's about building that, you know, just making sure that if you have volunteers working with you, you recognise them. I think I'm just hoping. I hope so. And I thank you so much for what you do. It sounds amazing.
Hannah, can I change the focus a little bit and ask you your opinion about the role of retired people as volunteers?
We love them. I think I want to use that word, not exploit, again, actually, because retired people are seen as this kind of, oh, they must be bored. They must need something to do. Well, in which case, let's give them something to do. I think another comment I made about highly skilled people being given the little jobs, let's not do that. You know, VSO has some really great policies on some of the people they employ. That you don't. It's not 19-year-olds on a gap year doing an ISO project. It's people with skills going out there and giving back. And I think that's probably the best way of mobilising people who are retired who want to volunteer. Because that's the other thing. Sometimes people who are retired get picked on to volunteer because they're there. And if you volunteered for one charity, someone else hears about it and they do again. And if you're a member of a church, next thing you know, you're church warden. That's aimed at a particular person in the audience. I think it's about, well, not exploiting. I think it's about inviting people and being okay if they say no, but I think it's mostly about recognizing that if you're retired, you have put a lot in, you've had training, you've had skills, you have something that to give to that role, so allow that person to do that. Don't just say have the little job, because not least because you'll stop being bored because you're doing nothing and be bored because you're stuffing envelopes. Is that what you wanted to hear, Les? Is that the kind of thing you wanted to hear? I'm sure there's a few jobs we can find for you in Eastbourne, though.
Thank you for what you had to say. I actually work in the charity sector as well. And one of the great things about coming to Greenbelt is it's a place of radical ideas. I'm involved a little bit with policy formulation in the charity sector, and it never ceases to amaze me how people don't think out of the box. And when we reflect on what's happened maybe over the last couple of years, we've seen so many fault lines in the commercial world, excessive pay, lies, and all that sort of thing. And the charity sector represents so much of what would be better in society and which mirrors Christian values. The key thing is, how do we get that onto the agenda and speak with a Christian voice about things like that?
I would say, first and foremost, I'd slightly challenge what you say about some charities, because I think it was 2007, Third Sector magazine did an article about the five chief executives charities earning more than £100,000. The rise of the private sector person having a midlife crisis and going into the charity sector is not necessarily helping the charity sector be as fair and as radical as it could be. That my vision of it. So there, my instinct is that as soon as you start talking about doing it because you're Christian or having a Christian voice, is you put a label on it that alienates the people that you want to hear what you have to say. I heard on the grapevine that Christian Aid were thinking about removing the word Christian from their title. I know a lot of people who work for Christian Aid and they're definitely not Christians. But mostly because some of the things they want to fund don't want it from Christian Aid. I think the best way, and I think it's not just the charity sector, I think the best way to live Christian values is to live your values and not tell people that they're Christian, because of what that word can mean to the people that hear it, and then they won't hear what you have to say, if that makes sense. But I do think that Christians in a workplace and in a sector should be accountable to each other. Because if we are trying to see the kingdom of God realised in this world, then we have to make sure that we're not bringing each other down or doing it in a way that doesn't actually reflect God. I do get embarrassed sometimes by things Christians do, and that reflects back at me. And it means that you can't quite see the good things they do. Richard Dawkins' book was chock-a-full of all the times Christians did bad things. Didn't say a word about the amazing things Christians did, probably because he didn't know they were necessarily Christians. Does that make sense? Partly. Yeah, buy me that pint.
Hi, I'm going to change the subject again.
Oh, okay.
I'm one of those people who's midway through their career who wants to use their skills but in the charity sector. I've worked in the NHS for a very long time.
Oh, bless you, poor thing.
Yeah. And I've accrued quite a lot of skills within that I kind of feel I want to use in the charity sector. But what I'm finding is exactly some things you're talking about. Either I have to volunteer for about the next 10 years, bearing in mind I have a mortgage and other responsibilities, or I have to change career completely. And I just wondered if you had any advice, tips, ideas about how somebody like me could use their skills or get into working for a charity without having to go in and be an 18-year-old again.
Well, first and foremost, do you have an entrepreneurial friend with a conscience? Because if so, you could consider the idea of trying to create some kind of niche social enterprise, something that's socially responsible. It's harder to start your own charity and get yourself paid. That's one extreme option. One thing I'd suggest is not going for the big charities. One of the really frustrating things is that they already know who's going to get that job. There was no point in you going for it. That person who'd been grafting away for 3 years is already in the running. The other thing is play to your strengths. So health charities, people who work with provision in local area, people who work with the NHS, actually. A lot of charities have to work with the NHS because of the funding thing that the guy said. And most of all, talk to people. Yes, volunteer, but volunteer on your terms. You know, do that thing which says, would you want advice on something? Do that thing which says, well, I can do a Saturday afternoon. Don't make yourself so available that you become one of those exploited volunteers that feels like you're having to do the graft to make yourself worthy. And the other thing is, don't tell anyone I told you this, but when you do your CV, every tiny little bit of unpaid work you've done, say it's voluntary work. Suddenly it grows very big at that point. Does that help? Yeah. But if you pint again, I'll talk about it. Yeah. Thank you for your questions. I feel really flattered. There's something really weird about standing here. And I think writing the talk, I didn't realise how much I'd learnt myself about stuff. And it's wonderful to feel like I've got something to give. Thank you.